Spearman. He had eaten his crackers, but he was still hungry. So he took the girls next to him when she wasn't looking, and munched them down as the battle raged on. His stomach still growled and grumbled. When was lunch? Or was it dinner time already? The Persians broke and ran, and the Spartans stood victorious on the field. The children cheered. They wanted to see it again.
"That's all for today," Deja said. "We'll continue tomorrow, and I'll show you some wolves. Now it's time for you to go to the playground."
"Playground?" John said. That was perfect. He could finally just sit on a swing, relax, and think for a moment. He ran out of the room, as did the other trainees. Chief Petty Officer Mendez and the trainers waited for them outside the classroom.
"Time for the playground," Mendez said, and waved the children closer. "It's a short run. Fall in."
The short run turned into 2 miles, and the playground was like nothing John had ever seen. It was a forest of 20-meter-tall wooden poles. Rope cargo nets and bridges stretched between the poles. They swayed, crossed, and crisscrossed one another, a maze suspended in the air. There were slide poles and knotted climbing ropes. There were swings and suspended platforms. There were ropes looped through pulleys and tied to baskets that looked sturdy enough to hoist a person.
"Trainees," Mendez said, "form 3 lines."
The instructors moved in to herd them, but John and the others made 3 rows without comments or fuss.
"The first person in every row will be team number 1, Mendez said. "The second person on each row will be team number 2, and so on. If you do not understand this, speak up now."
No one spoke. John looked to his right. A boy with sandy hair, green eyes, and darkly tanned skin gave him a weary smile. Stenciled on his sweat top was Samuel, 034. In the row behind Samuel was a girl. She was taller than John and skinny, with a long mane of dyed blue hair. Kelly, 087. She didn't look too happy to see him.
"Today's game," Mendez explained, "is called Ring the Bell."
He pointed to the tallest pole on the playground. It stood an additional 10 meters above the others and had a steel slide pole next to it. Hung at the very top of that pole was a brass bell.
"There are many ways to get to the bell," he told them. "I leave it up to each team to find their own way. When every member of your team has rung the bell, you are to get groundside double time and run back here to the finish line."
Mendez took his baton and scratched a straight line in the sand. John raised his hand. Mendez glared at him for a moment with those black, unblinking eyes.
"A question, trainee?"
"What do we win?"
Mendez cocked one eyebrow and appraised John.
"You win dinner, number 117. Tonight, dinner is roast turkey, gravy and mashed potatoes, corn on the cob, brownies and ice cream."
A murmur of approval swept through the children.
"But,"
Mendez added,
"for there to be winners, there must be a loser. The last team to finish goes without food."
The children fell silent and then looked at each other warily.
"Make ready," Mendez said.
"I'm Sam,"
the boy whispered to John and the girl on his team.
She said, "I'm Kelly."
John just looked at them and said nothing. The girl would slow him down. Too bad. He was hungry, and he wasn't about to let them make him lose.
"Go!"
Mendez shouted. John ran through the pack of children and scrambled up a cargo net onto a platform. He raced across the bridge, jumped onto the next platform just in time. The bridge flicked and sent 5 others into the water below. He paused at the rope tied to the large basket. It ran up through a pulley and then back down. He didn't think he was strong enough to pull himself up in it. Instead, he tackled a knotted climbing rope and scrunched his body up. The rope swung wildly around the center pole. John looked down and almost lost his grip. It looked twice as far down as it had looked from the ground. He saw all the others, some climbing, others floundering in the water, getting up and starting over. No one was as close to the bell as he was. He swallowed his fear and kept climbing up. He thought of the ice cream and chocolate brownies and how he was going to win. John got to the top, grabbed the bell, and rang it 3 times. He then clasped the steel pole and slid all the way to the ground, falling into a pile of cushions. He got up and ran smiling all the way to the chief petty officer. John crossed the finish line and gave a victory cry.
"I was the first," he said, panting.
Mendez nodded and made a check on his clipboard. John watched as the others made it up and rang the bell, then raced across the finish line. Kelly and Sam had trouble. They got stuck in a line to get to the bell as everyone bunched up at the end. They finally rang the bell, slid down together, but they crossed the finish line last. They glared at John. He shrugged.
"Good work, trainees," Mendez said, and he beamed at them all. "Let's get back to the barracks and chow down."
The children, covered in mud and leaning on each other, cheered.
"All except Team 3, Mendez said,
and looked at Sam, Kelly, and then John.
"But I won," John protested. "I was the first."
"Yes, you were first," Mendez explained. "But your team came in last."
He then addressed all the children.
"Remember this. You don't win unless your team wins. One person winning at the expense of the group means that you lose."
John ran in a stupor all the way back to the barracks. It wasn't fair. He had won. How can you win and still lose? He watched as the others stuffed themselves with turkey, white meat dripping with gravy. They spooned down mountains of vanilla ice cream and left the mess hall with chocolate encrusting the corners of their mouths. John got a liter of water. He drank it, but it didn't have any taste. It did nothing to fill his hunger. He wanted to cry, but he was too tired. He collapsed in his bunk, thinking of ways to get even with Sam and Kelly for messing him up, but he couldn't think. Every muscle and bone ached. John fell asleep as soon as his head hit the flat pillow. The next day was the same. Calisthenics and running all morning, then class until the afternoon. Today, Deja taught them about wolves. The classroom became a holographic meadow, and the children watched 7 wolves hunt a moose. The pack worked together, striking wherever the giant beast wasn't facing. It was fascinating and horrifying to watch the wolves track down and then devour an animal many times their size. John avoided Sam and Kelly in the classroom. He stole a few extra crackers when no one was looking, but they didn't dull his hunger. After class, they ran back to the playground. Today it was different. There were fewer bridges and more complicated rope and pulley systems. The pole with the bell was now 20 meters taller than any of the others.
"Same teams as yesterday," Mendez announced.
Sam and Kelly walked up to John. Sam shoved him. John's temper flared. He wanted to hit Sam in the face. But he was too tired. He needed all his strength to get to the bell.
"You better help us," Sam hissed, "or I'll push you off one of those platforms."
"And I'll jump on top of you," Kelly added.
"Okay," John whispered. "Just try not to slow me down."
John examined the course. It was like doing a maze on paper, only this one twisted and turned into and out of the page. Many bridges and rope ladders led to dead ends. He squinted, then found one possible route. He nudged Sam and Kelly, then pointed.
"Look," he said, "that basket and rope on the far side. It goes straight to the top. It's a long pull, though."
He flexed his biceps, uncertain if he could make it in his weakened state.
"We can do it,"
Sam said. John glanced at the other teams. They were searching the course as well.
"We'll have to make a quick run for it," he said. "Make sure no one else gets there first."
"I'm fast," Kelly said. "Real fast."
"Trainees, get ready,"
Mendez shouted.
"Okay," John said. "You sprint ahead and hold it for us."
"Go!"
Kelly shot forward. John had never seen anyone move like her. She ran like the wolves he had seen today. Her feet seemed barely to touch the ground. She got to the basket. John and Sam were only halfway there. One boy beat them to the basket.
"Get out,"
he ordered Kelly.
"I'm going up."
Sam and John ran up and pushed him back.
"Wait your turn,"
Sam said. John and Sam joined Kelly in the basket. Together they pulled on the rope and raised themselves up. There was a lot of rope. For every 3 meters they pulled, they only rose 1 meter. A breeze made the basket sway and bounce into the pole.
"Faster,"
John urged. They pulled as one person, six hands working in unison, and accelerated into the sky. They didn't get there first. They were third. Each of them got to ring the bell, though. Kelly, Sam, and John. They slid down the pole. Kelly and Sam waited for John to land, and then together they ran across the finish line. Chief Petty Officer Mendez watched them. He didn't say anything, but John thought he saw a smile flicker across his face. Sam clapped John and Kelly on their backs.
"That was good work," Sam said.
He looked thoughtful for a moment, then said,
"We can be friends. I mean, if you want, it'll be no big deal."
Kelly shrugged and replied,
"Sure."
"Okay,"
John said.
"Friends."
Chapter 5. 0630 hours, July 12th, 2519, Military Calendar. Epsilon Eridani System, Reach Military Wilderness Training Preserve, Planet Reach. John held on tight as the dropship accelerated up and over a jagged snow-capped mountain range. The sun peaked over the horizon and washed the white snow with pinks and oranges. The other members of his unit pressed their faces to the windows and watched. Sam sat next to him and looked outside.
"Nice place for a snowball fight."
"You'll lose,"
Kelly said. She leaned over John's shoulder to get a better look at the terrain.
"I'm a dead aim with snowballs."
She scratched the stubble of her shorn hair.
"Dead is right,"
John muttered, "especially when you load them with rocks." CPO Mendez stepped from the cockpit into the passenger compartment. The trainees stood and snapped to attention.
"At ease, and sit down."
The silver at Mendez's temples had grown to a band across the side of his closely shaved hair. But if anything, he had gotten stronger and tougher since John had first laid eyes on him 2 years ago.
"Today's mission will be simple for a change."
Mendez's bass voice easily penetrated the roar of the dropship's engines. He handed a stack of papers to Kelly.
"Pass these out, recruit."
"Sir!"
She saluted smartly and handed one paper to each of the 75 children in the squad.
"These are portions of maps of the local region. You will be set down by yourselves. You will then navigate to a marked extraction point, and we will pick you up there."
John turned his map over. It was just one part of a much larger map. No drop or extraction point marked. How was he supposed to navigate without a reference point? But he knew this was part of the mission, to answer that question on his own.
"One more thing," Mendez said. "The last trainee to make it to the extraction point will be left behind."
He glanced at a window.
"And it's a very long walk back."
John didn't like it. He wasn't going to lose, but he didn't want anyone else to lose either. The thought of Kelly or Sam or any of the others marching all the way back made him uneasy, if they could make it all the way back, alone, over those mountains.
"First drop in 3 minutes,"
Mendez barked.
"Trainee 117, you're up first."
"Sir, yes, sir,"
John replied. He glanced out the window and scanned the terrain. There was a ring of jagged mountains, a valley thick with cedars, and a ribbon of silver, a river that fed into a lake. John nudged Sam, pointed to the river, then jerked his thumb toward the lake. Sam nodded, then pulled Kelly aside and pointed out the window. Sam and Kelly moved quickly down the line of seated trainees. The ship decelerated. John felt his stomach rise as they dropped toward the ground.
"Trainee 117, front and center!"
Mendez stepped to the rear of the compartment as the ship's tail split and a ramp extended. Cold air blasted into the ship. He patted John on the shoulder.
Watch out for wolves in the forest, 117.
Yes, sir.
John looked over his shoulder at the others. His teammates gave him an almost imperceptible nod. Good. Everyone got his message. He ran down the ramp and into the forest. The dropship's engines roared to life, and it rose high into the cloudless sky. He zipped up his jacket. He wore only fatigues, boots, and a heavy parka. Not exactly the gear he'd packed for a prolonged stay in the wilderness. John started toward one particularly sharp peak he had spotted from the air. The river lay in that direction. He'd follow it downstream and meet the others at the lake. He marched through the woods until he heard the gurgling of a stream. He got close enough to see the direction of the flow, then headed back into the forest. Mendez's exercise often had a twist to them. Stun mines on the obstacle course, snipers with paint pellet guns during parade drills. And with the chief up in that dropship, John wasn't about to reveal his position unless he had a good reason. He passed a blueberry bush and took the time to strip it before he moved on. This was the first time in months he had been alone and could just think. He popped a handful of berries into his mouth and chewed. He thought about the place that had been his home, his parents. But more and more that seemed like a dream. John knew it wasn't, and that he had once had a different life. But this was the life he wanted. He was a soldier. He had an important job to train for. Mendez said they were the Navy's best and brightest, that they were the only hope for peace. He liked that. Before, he never knew what he would be when he grew up. He never really thought about anything other than watching vids and playing. Nothing had been a challenge. Now, every day was a challenge and a new adventure. John knew more things, thanks to Deja, than he ever thought he could have learned at his old school. Algebra and trigonometry, the history of 100 battles and kings. He could string a tripline, fire a rifle, and treat a chest wound. Mendez had shown him how to be strong, not only with his body, but strong with his head, too. He had a family here, Kelly, Sam, and all the others in his squad. The thought of his squad mates brought him back to Mendez's mission. One of them was going to be left behind. There had to be a way to get them all home. John decided he wasn't going to leave if he couldn't figure it out. He arrived at the edge of the lake, stood, and listened. John heard an owl hooting in the distance. He marched toward the sound. "Hey, owl," he said when he was close. Sam stepped out from behind a tree and grinned.
"That's Chief Owl to you, trainee."
They walked around the circumference of the lake, gathering the rest of the children in the squad. John counted them to make sure. 75.
"Let's get the map pieces together," Kelly suggested.
"Good idea," John said. "Sam, take 3 and scout the area. I don't want any of the chief's surprises sneaking up on us."
"Right."
Sam picked Fahajad, James, and Linda, and then the 4 of them took off into the brush. Kelly collected the map pieces and settled in the shade of an ancient cedar tree.
"Some of these don't belong, and some are copies," she said, and she laid them out. "Yes, here's an edge. Got it. This is the lake, the river, and here."
She pointed to a distant patch of green.
"That's gotta be the extraction point."
She shook her head and frowned.
"If the legend on this map is right, it's a full day's hike, though. We better get started."
John whistled, and a moment later Sam and his scouts returned.
"Let's move out," John said.
No one argued. They fell into line behind Kelly as she navigated. Sam blazed the trail ahead. He had the best eyes and ears. Several times he stopped and signaled everyone to freeze or hide, but it turned out to be just a rabbit or a bird. After several miles of marching, Sam dropped back. He whispered to John,
"This is too easy. It's not like any of the chief's normal field exercises."
John nodded.
"I've been thinking that, too. Just keep your eyes and ears sharp."
They stopped at noon to stretch and eat berries they had gathered along the trail. Fahajad spoke up.
"I want to know one thing," he said.
He paused to wipe the sweat off his dark skin.
We're going to get to the extraction point at the same time. So who's getting left behind? We should decide now.
Draw straws, someone suggested.
No, John said and stood. No one's being left behind. We're going to figure a way to get us all out.
How?
Kelly asked, scratching her head.
Mendez said...
I know what he said, but there's got to be a way. I just haven't thought of one yet. Even if it has to be me that stays behind, I'll make sure everyone gets back to the base.
John started marching again.
Come on, we're wasting time.
The others fell in behind him. The shadows of the trees lengthened and melted together, and the sun turned the edge of the sky red. Kelly halted and motioned for everyone else to stop.
We're almost there,
she whispered.
Me and Sam will scout it out, John said. Everyone fall out and keep quiet.
The rest of the children silently followed his orders. John and Sam crept through the underbrush and then hunkered down at the edge of a meadow. The dropship sat in the center of the grassy field. Her floodlights illuminated everything for 30 meters. Six men sat on the open launch ramp, smoking cigarettes and passing a canteen between themselves. Sam motioned to drop back.
You recognize them?
He whispered.
No, you?
Sam shook his head.
They're not in uniform. They don't look like any soldiers I've ever seen. Maybe they're rebels. Maybe they stole the dropship and killed the chief.
No way, John said. Nothing can kill the chief. But one thing's for sure. I don't think we can just walk up there and get a free ride back to the base. Let's go back.
They crept back into the woods and then explained the situation to the others.
What do you want to do? Kelly asked him.
John wondered why she thought he had an answer. He looked around and saw everyone was watching him, waiting for him to speak. He shifted on his feet. He had to say something.
Okay, we don't know who these men are or what they'll do when they see us, so we find out.
The children nodded, seeming to think this was the right thing to do.
Here's how, John told them. First, I'll need a rabbit.
That's me,
Kelly said and sprang to her feet. I'm the fastest.
Good,
John said. You go to the edge of the meadow, and then let them see you. I'll go along and hide nearby and watch. In case anything happens to you, I'll report back to the others.
She nodded.
Then you lure a few back here. Run right past this spot. Sam, you'll be out in the open, pretending like you've broken your leg.
Gotcha,
Sam said. He walked over to Vahajan and had him scrape his skin with his boot. Blood welled from the wound.
The rest of you, John said, wait in the woods in a big circle. If they try to do anything but help Sam...
John made a fist with his right hand and slammed it into his open palm.
Remember the moose and the wolves?
They all nodded and grinned. They had seen that lesson many times in Deja's classroom.
Get some rocks,
John told them. Kelly stripped off her parka, stretched her legs and knees.
Okay, she said. Let's do this.
Sam lay down, clutching his leg.
Ooh, it hurts. Help me.
Don't overdo it, John said, and kicked some dirt on him, or they'll know it's a setup.
John and Kelly then crept toward the meadow and halted a few meters from the edge. He whispered to her,
If you want me to be the rabbit...
She slugged him in the shoulder, hard.
You think I can't do my part?
I take it back,
he said, rubbing his shoulder.
Sheesh.
John moved off 10 meters to her flank, took cover, and watched. Kelly emerged at the edge of the meadow, stepping into the illumination from the dropship's floodlights.
Hey,
she said, waving her arms over her head.
Over here. You got any food? I'm starving.
The men slowly stood and pulled out stun batons.
There's one, John heard them whisper. I'll get her. The rest of you stay here and wait for the others. This'll be easy.
The man cautiously approached Kelly, a stun baton held behind his back so she couldn't see it. She stayed put and waited for him to get closer.
Hang on a sec,
she said.
I dropped my jacket back there. I'll be right back.
She turned and ran. The man leapt after her, but she had already vanished into the shadows.
Stop!
"This'll be too easy," one of the other men said. "Kids won't know what hit them." Another remarked, "Fish in a barrel."
John had heard enough. He ran after Kelly, but realized that neither he nor the other man had a chance to catch her. He halted when he got close to where Sam lay. The man stopped. He looked around, his eyes not quite adjusted to the dark, then spotted Sam on the ground holding his bloody leg.
"Please help me," Sam whimpered. "It's broken."
"I got your broken leg right here, kid."
The man raised his baton. John picked up a rock. He threw it, but missed. The man spun around.
"Who's there?"
Sam rolled to his feet and darted away. There was a rustling in the forest, then a hail of stones whistled through the trees, pelting the man. Kelly appeared and sidearmed a rock as hard as she could and hit the man dead center in the forehead. He toppled and slammed into the ground. The other children moved in.
"What do we do with him?"
Sam asked.
"It's just an exercise, right?"
Fahajat said.
"He has to be with Mendez."
John rolled the man over. A trickle of blood snaked from his head into his eye socket.
"You heard him," John whispered. "You saw what he was going to do to Sam. Mendez or our trainers would never do that to us, ever. He's got no uniform, no insignia. He's not one of us."
John kicked the man in the face and then the ribs. The man reflexively curled into a ball.
"Get his baton."
Sam grabbed the weapon. He kicked him, too.
"Now we go back and get the others," John told them. "Kelly, you be the rabbit again. Just get them to the edge of the clearing. Duck out, and let us do the rest."
She nodded and started back to the meadow. The rest of the squad fanned out, collecting rocks along the way. After a minute, Kelly stepped onto the grassy field and shouted,
"That guy fell and hit his head! Over here!"
The five remaining men stood and ran toward her. When they were close enough, John whistled. The air suddenly swarmed with stones. The men held up their hands and tried to protect themselves. They dropped and covered their heads. John whistled again, and 75 children charged screaming toward the bewildered men. The men got up to defend themselves. They looked stunned, like they couldn't believe what they were seeing. Sam smashed his baton over a man's head. Fahajad was hit squarely in the face by one man's fist, and he fell. The men were overwhelmed by a wave of flesh, beaten to the ground with fists and stones and boots until they no longer moved. John stood over their bleeding bodies. He was mad. They would have hurt him and his squad. He wanted to kick in their skulls. He took a deep breath and then exhaled. He had better things to do and bigger problems to figure out. Anger would have to wait.
"Want to call Mendez now?"
Sam asked as he pulled Fahajad shakily to his feet.
"Not yet,"
John told him. He marched onto the dropship. No one else was on board. John accessed the comm system and opened the mail link. He linked up with Deja. Her face appeared, a scratchy hologram hovering over the terminal.
"Good evening, Trainee 117, she said. "Do you have a homework question?"
"Kind of," he replied. "One of Chief Petty Officer Mendez's assignments."
"Ah." After a moment's pause, she said, "Very well."
"I'm in a Pelican dropship. There's no pilot, but I need to get home. Teach me to fly it, please."
Deja shook her head.
"You are not rated to fly that craft, Trainee, but I can help. Do you see the winged icon in the corner of your screen? Tap it 3 times.
John tapped it, and 100 icons and displays filled the screen.
"Touch the green arrows at 9 o'clock, twice," she told him.
He did, and then the words, "Autopilot activated," flashed on screen.
"I have control now," Deja said. "I will get you home."
"Hang on a second,"
John said, and ran outside.
"Everyone on board, double time!"
The children ran onto the ship. Kelly paused and asked,
"Who's getting left behind?"
"No one," John said. "Just get in."
He made sure he was the last on the ship and then said,
"Okay, Deja, get us out of here."
The dropship's jets roared to life, and it rose into the sky. John stood at attention in Chief Petty Officer Mendez's office. He had never been in here. No one had. A trickle of sweat dripped down his back. The dark wood paneling and the smell of cigar smoke made him feel claustrophobic. Mendez glowered at John as he read the report on his clipboard. The door opened, and Dr. Halsey walked in. Mendez stood, gave her a curt nod, and then sat back in his padded chair.
"Hello, John," Dr. Halsey said.
She sat across from Mendez, crossed her legs, and then adjusted her gray skirt.
"Dr. Halsey?"
John replied instantly. He saluted. None of the other grown-ups called him by his first name, ever. He didn't understand why she did.
"Trainee 117," Mendez snapped. "Tell me again why you stole UNSC property and why you attacked the men I had assigned to guard it."
John wanted to explain that he was just doing what had to be done, that he was sorry, that he would do anything to make it up. But John knew the chief hated whiners, almost as much as he hated excuses.
"Sir," John said, "the guards were out of uniform, no insignia. They failed to identify themselves, sir."
Mendez mused over the report again.
"So it seems. And the ship?"
"I took my squad home, sir. I was the last on board, so if anyone should have been left—"
"I didn't ask for a passenger list, crewman."
His voice softened to a growl, and he turned to Dr. Halsey.
"What are we going to do with this one?"
"Do?"
She pushed her glasses higher on her nose and examined John.
"I think that's obvious, Chief. Make him a squad leader."
Chapter 6 1130 hours, March 9th, 2525, Military Calendar. Epsilon Eridani System. Office of Naval Intelligence Medical Facility. In orbit, around planet Reach.
"I want that transmission decoded now,"
Dr. Halsey snapped at Deja.
"The encryption scheme is extremely complex," replied Deja, with a hint of irritation in her normally glass-smooth voice. "I don't even know why they bothered. Who else but Beta 5 Division even has the resources to use this data?"
"Spare me the banter, Deja. I'm not in the mood. Just concentrate on the decryption."
"Yes, Doctor."
Dr. Halsey paced across the antiseptic white tile of the observation room. One side of the room was filled with floor-to-ceiling terminals that monitored the vital signs of the children. Test subjects, she corrected herself. They displayed drug uptake rates and winking green, blue, and red status indicators, EKGs, pulse rates, and 100 other pieces of medical data. The other side of the observation room overlooked dozens of translucent domes, windows into the surgical bays on the level below. Each bay was a sealed environment, staffed with the best surgeons and biotechnicians that the Office of Naval Intelligence could drum up. The bays had been scrubbed and irradiated and were in the final preparation stages to receive and hold the special biohazardous materials.
"Done,"
Deja announced.
"The file awaits your inspection, Doctor."
Dr. Halsey stopped her pacing and sat.
"On my glasses, please, Deja."
Her glasses scanned retinal and brain patterns, and the security barrier of the file lifted. With a blink of her eyes, she opened the file. It read, "United Nations Space Command Priority Transmission, 09872H-98. Encryption code, red. Public key, file/excised access omega. From Admiral Yusonaris Jerome, Chief Medical Officer, UNSC Research Station Hopeful. To Dr. Catherine Elizabeth Halsey, MD, PhD, Special Civilian Consultant, Civilian Identification Number 10141-026-SRB4695. Subject, mitigating factors and relative biological risks associated with queried experimental medical procedures. Classification, restricted, BGH directive. Start file. Catherine, I am afraid further analysis has yielded no viable alternatives to mitigate the risks in your proposed hypothetical experimentation. I have, however, attached the synopsis of my team's findings as well as all relevant case studies. Perhaps you'll find them useful.
I hope it is a hypothetical study. The use of bonobo chimpanzees in your proposal is troublesome. These animals are expensive and rare now since they are no longer bred in captivity. I would hate to see such valuable specimens wasted in some Section 3 project. Best, YJ. She winced at the veiled rebuke in the Admiral's communique. He had never approved of her decision to work with the Office of Naval Intelligence, and made his disappointment with his star pupil evident every time she visited Hopeful. It was hard enough to justify the morality of the course she was about to embark on. Jerome's disapproval only made her decision more difficult. Dr. Halsey gritted her teeth and returned to the report. Synopsis of Chemical Biological Risks. Warning. The following procedures are classified Level 3 experimental. Primate test subjects must be cleared through UNSC Quartermaster General Office Code 0B434. Follow Gamma Code Biohazard Disposal Protocol. Number 1. Carbide ceramic ossification. Advanced material grafting onto skeletal structures to make bones virtually unbreakable. Recommended coverage not to exceed 3% total bone mass because of significant white blood cell necrosis. Specific risk for pre- and near-postpubescent adolescents, skeletal growth spurts may cause irreparable bone pulverization. See attached case studies. Number 2. Muscular enhancement injections. Protein complex is injected intramuscularly to increase tissue density and decrease lactase recovery time. Risk, 5% of test subjects experience a fatal cardiac volume increase. Number 3. Catalytic thyroid implant. Platinum pellet containing human growth hormone catalyst is implanted in the thyroid to boost growth of skeletal and muscle tissues. Risk, rare instances of elephantiasis, suppressed sexual drive. Number 4. Occipital capillary reversal. Submergence and boosted blood vessel flow beneath the rods and cones of subject's retina. Produces a marked visual perception increase. Risk, retinal rejection and detachment. Permanent blindness. See attached autopsy reports. Number 5. Superconducting fibrication of neural dendrites. Alteration of bioelectrical nerve transduction to shielded electronic transduction. 300% increase in subject reflexes. Anecdotal evidence of marked increase in intelligence, memory, and creativity. Risk, significant instances of Parkinson's disease and Fletcher's syndrome. End file. Press Enter to open linked attachments. Dr. Halsey closed the file. She erased all traces of it, sent Deja to track the file pathways all the way back to Hopeful, and destroy Admiral Jerome's notes and files relative to this incident. She removed her glasses and pinched the bridge of her nose.
"I'm sorry," Deja said. "I, too, had hoped there would be some new process to lower the risks."
Dr. Halsey sighed.
"I have doubts, Deja. I thought the reason so compelling when we first started Project Spartan. Now, I just don't know. I have been over the ONI projections of outer colony stability 3 times, Doctor. Their conclusion is correct. Massive rebellion within 20 years, unless drastic military action is taken. And you know the drastic military action the brass would like. The Spartans are our only option to avoid overwhelming civilian losses. They will be the perfect pinpoint strike force. They can prevent a civil war."
"Only if they survive to fulfill that mission," Dr. Halsey countered. "We should delay the procedures. More research needs to be done. We could use the time to work on Mjolnir. We need time to—"
"There is another reason to proceed expeditiously," Deja said. "Although I am loath to bring this to your attention, I must. If the Office of Naval Intelligence detects a delay in their prize project, you will likely be replaced by someone who harbors fewer doubts. And regrettably for the children, most likely someone less qualified."
"I hate this." Dr. Halsey got up and strode to the fire exit. "And sometimes, Deja, I hate you too."
She left the observation room. Mendez was waiting for her in the hallway.
"Walk with me, Chief," she said. He followed without a word as they took the stairs to the pre-op wing of the hospital. They entered room 117. John lay in bed, and an IV drip was attached to his arm. His head had been shaved, and incision vectors had been lasered onto his entire body. Despite these indignities, Dr. Halsey marveled at what a spectacular physical specimen he had grown into. 14 years old, and he had the body of an 18-year-old Olympic athlete, and a mind the equal of any Naval Academy honors graduate. Dr. Halsey forced the best smile she could muster.
"How are you feeling?"
"I'm fine, ma'am," John replied groggily. "The nurse said the sedation would take effect soon. I'm fighting it to see how long I can stay awake." His eyelids fluttered. "It's not easy." John spotted Mendez, and he struggled to sit up and salute, but failed.
"I know this is one of the chief's exercises, but I don't know what the twist is. Can you tell me, Dr. Halsey, just this time, how do I win?"
Mendez looked away. Dr. Halsey leaned closer to John as he closed his eyes and started to breathe deeply.
"I'll tell you how to win, John," she whispered. "You have to survive."
Chapter 7 0000 Hours, March 30th, 2525, Military Calendar. UNSC Carrier Atlas, en route to the Lambda Serpentis System.
"And so we commit the bodies of our fallen brothers to space."
Mendez solemnly closed his eyes for a moment, the ceremony completed. He pressed a control, and the ash canisters moved slowly into the ejection tubes, and the void beyond. John stood rigidly at attention. The carrier's missile launch bays, normally cramped, overcrowded, and bustling with activity, were unusually quiet. The Atlas's firing deck had been cleared of munitions and crew. Long, unadorned black banners now hung from the bay's overhead gantries.
"Honors! Ten hut!"
Mendez barked. John and the other surviving Spartans saluted in unison.
"Duty," Mendez said. "Honor and self-sacrifice. Death does not diminish these qualities in a soldier. We shall remember."
A series of thumps resounded through the Atlas's hull as the canisters were hurled into space. The viewscreen flickered and displayed a field of stars. The canisters appeared one by one, quickly falling behind the carrier as it continued on its course. John watched. With each of the stainless steel cylinders that drifted by, he felt that he was losing a part of himself. It felt like leaving his people behind. Mendez's face might as well have been chiseled from stone for all the emotion it showed. He finished his protracted salute and then said,
"Crewman, dismissed!"
Not everything had been lost. John glanced around the launch chamber. Sam, Kelly, and 30 others still stood at attention in their black dress uniforms. They had made it unharmed through the last... mission wasn't quite the word, more or less. There were a dozen others, though, who had lived, but were no longer soldiers. It hurt John to look at them. Fahajad sat in a wheelchair, shaking uncontrollably. Kirk and Renee were in neutral buoyancy gel tanks, breathing through respirators. Their bones had been so twisted they no longer looked human. There were others, still alive, but with injuries so critical they could not be moved. Orderlies pushed Fahajad and the other injured toward the elevator. John strode toward them and stopped, blocking their path.
"Stand fast, crewman," he demanded. "Where are you taking my men?"
The orderly halted, and his eyes widened. He swallowed and then said,
"Sir, I have my orders, sir."
"Squad leader,"
Mendez called out.
"A moment."
"Stay,"
John told the orderly, and marched to face Chief Mendez.
"Yes, sir."
"Let them go," Mendez said quietly. "They can't fight anymore. They don't belong here."
John inadvertently glanced at the viewscreen and the long line of canisters as they shrank in the distance.
"What will happen to my men?"
The Navy takes care of its own, Mendez replied, and lifted his chin a little higher. They may no longer be the fastest or the strongest soldiers, but they still have sharp minds. They can still plan missions, analyze data, troubleshoot ops.
John exhaled a sigh of relief.
That's all any of us ask for, sir. A chance to serve.
He turned to face Fahajad and the others. He snapped to attention and saluted. Fahajad managed to raise one shaking arm and return the salute.
The orderlies wheeled them away. John looked at what remained of his squad. None of them had moved since the memorial ceremony. They were waiting for their next mission.
Our orders, sir?
John asked. 2 days full bed rest, squad leader. Then microgravity physical therapy aboard the Atlas until you recover from the side effects of your augmentation.
Side effects. John flexed his hand. He was clumsy now. Sometimes you could barely walk without falling. Dr. Halsey had assured him that these side effects were a good sign.
Your brain must relearn how to move your body with faster reflexes and stronger muscles, she told him.
But his eyes hurt, and they bled a little in the morning, too. He had constant headaches. Every bone in his body ached. John didn't understand any of this. He only knew that he had a duty to perform, and now he feared he wouldn't be able to.
Is that all, sir?
He asked Mendez.
No, the chief replied. Deja will be running your squad through the dropship pilot simulator as soon as they're up to it, and, he added, if they are up for the challenge, she wanted to cover some more organic chemistry and complex algebra.
Yes, sir, John replied. We're up to the challenge.
Good.
John continued to stand fast.
Was there something else, squad leader?
John furrowed his brow, hesitated, and then finally said,
I was squad leader. The last mission was therefore my responsibility, and members of my squad died. What did I do wrong?
Mendez stared at John with his impenetrable black eyes. He glanced at the squad, then back to John.
Walk with me.
He led John to the viewscreen. He stood and watched as the last of the canisters vanished into the darkness.
A leader must be ready to send the soldiers under his command to their deaths, Mendez said without turning to face John. You do this because your duty to the UNSC supersedes your duty to yourself or even your crew.
John looked away from the viewscreen. He couldn't look at the emptiness anymore. He didn't want to think of his teammates, friends who were like brothers and sisters to him, forever lost.
It is acceptable, Mendez said, to spend their lives if necessary.
He finally turned and met John's gaze.
It is not acceptable, however, to waste those lives. Do you understand the difference?
I believe I understand, sir, John said. But which was it on that last mission? Lives spent or lives wasted?
Mendez turned back toward the blackness of space and didn't answer. 0430 hours, April 22nd, 2525, military calendar. UNSC carrier Atlas, on patrol in the Lambda Serpentis system. John oriented himself as he entered the gym. From the stationary corridor, it was easy to see that this section of the Atlas rotated. The constant acceleration gave the circular walls a semblance of gravity. Unlike the other portions of the carrier, however, this section wasn't cylindrical, but rather a segmented cone. The outer portion was wider and rotated more slowly than the narrower inner portion, simulating gravitational forces from one quarter to two gravities along the length of the gym. There were free weights, punching and speed bags, a boxing ring, and machines to stretch and tone every muscle group. No one else was up this early. He had the place to himself. John started with arm curls. He went to the center section, calibrated at 1G, and picked up a 20-kilogram dumbbell. It felt wrong, too light. The spin must be off. He set the weights down and picked up a 40-kilogram set. That felt right.
For the last 3 weeks, the Spartans had gone through a daily routine of stretching, isometric exercises, light sparring drills, and lots of eating. They were under orders to consume 5 high-protein meals a day. After every meal, they had to report to the ship's medical bay for a series of mineral and vitamin injections. John was looking forward to getting back to Reach and his normal routine. There were only 32 soldiers left in his squad. 30 candidates had washed out of the Spartan program. They died during the augmentation process. The other dozen, suffering from side effects of the process, had been permanently reassigned within the Office of Naval Intelligence. He missed them all. But he and the others had to go on. They had to recover and prove themselves all over again. John wished Chief Mendez had warned him. He could have prepared. Maybe that was the trick to the last mission, to learn to be prepared for anything. He wouldn't let his guard down again. He took a seat at the leg machine, set it to the maximum weight, but it felt too light. He moved to the high G end of the gym. Things felt normal again. John worked every machine, then moved to a speed bag, a leather ball attached to the floor and ceiling by a thick elastic band. There were only certain allowed frequencies at which the bag could be hit, or it gyrated chaotically. His fist jabbed forward, cobra quick, and struck. The speed bag moved, but slowly, like it was underwater. Far too slowly, considering how hard he had hit it. The tension on the line must be turned way down. He twanged the line and it hummed. It was tight. Was everything broken in this room? He pulled a pin from the locking collar on the bench press. John walked to the center section, supposedly 1G. He held the pin a meter off the deck and dropped it. It clattered on the deck. It looked as if it had fallen normally, but somehow it also looked slow to John. He set the timer on his watch and dropped the pin again. 45 hundredths of a second. 1 meter in about a half second. He forgot the formula for distance and acceleration, so he ran through the calculus and re-derived the equation. He even did the square root. He frowned. He had always struggled with math before. The answer was a gravitational acceleration of 9.8 meters per second squared, one standard G. So the room was rotating correctly. He was out of calibration. His experiment was cut short. 4 men entered the gym. They were out of uniform, wearing only shorts and boots. Their heads were cleanly shaven. They were all heavily muscled, lean and fit. The largest of the 4 was taller than John. Scars covered one side of his face. John could tell they were special forces. Orbital drop shock troopers. The ODSTs had the traditional tattoos burned onto their arms. Drop jet jumpers and feet first into hell. Hell jumpers. The infamous 105th. John had overheard mess hall chatter about them. They had a reputation for success and for brutality, even against fellow soldiers. John gave them a polite nod. They just brushed past him and started on the high gravity free weights. The largest ODST lifted the bar of the bench press. He struggled, and the bar wavered unsteadily. The iron plates on the right end slid off and fell to the deck. The opposite end of the bar tilted, and he dropped the weight, almost crushing his spotter's foot. Startled by the noise, John jumped up.
"What the—"
The big ODST stood and glared at the locking collar that had slipped off.
"Someone took the pin," he growled, and turned to John.
John picked up the pin.
"The error was mine," he said, and stepped forward. "My apologies."
The 4 ODSTs moved as one toward John. The big guy with the scars stood a hand's breadth away from John's nose.
"Why don't you take that pin and shove it, meat?" he said, grinning. "Or better yet, maybe I should make you eat it."
He nodded to his friends. John only knew 3 ways to react to people. If they were his superior officers, he obeyed them. If they were part of his squad, he helped them. If they were a threat, he neutralized them. So when the men surrounding him moved, he hesitated. Not because he was afraid, but because these men could have fallen into any of John's three categories. He didn't know their rank. They were fellow servicemen in the UNSC, but at the moment, they didn't seem friendly. The two men flanking him grabbed John's biceps. The one behind him tried to slip an arm around his neck. John hunched his shoulders and tucked his chin to his chest so he couldn't be choked. He whipped his right elbow over the hand holding him, pinned it to his side, and then straight-punched the man and broke his nose. The other three reacted, tightening their grips and stepping closer. But like the dropped pin, they moved slowly. John ducked and slipped out of the unsuccessful headlock. He spun free, breaking the grasp of the man on his left at the same time.
"Stand down!"
A booming voice echoed across the gym. A sergeant stepped into the gym and strode toward them. Unlike Mendez, who was fit and trim and was always serious, this man's stomach bulged over his belt, and he looked bemused. John snapped to attention. The others stood there and continued to glare at John.
"Sarge," the man with the bleeding nose said, "we were just..."
"Did I ask you a question?" the sergeant barked.
"No, sergeant,"
the man replied. The sergeant eyed John, then the ODSTs.
"You're all so eager to fight, get in the ring and go to it."
"Sir!"
John said. He went to the boxing ring, slipped through the ropes, and stood there waiting. This was starting to make sense. It was a mission. John had received orders from a superior officer, and the four men were now targets. The big ODST pushed through the ropes, and the others gathered to watch.
"I'm gonna rip you to pieces, meat," he grunted through clenched teeth.
John sprang off his back foot and launched his entire weight behind his first strike. His fist smashed into the man's wide chin. John's left hand followed and impacted on the soldier's jaw. The man's hands came up. John stepped in, pinned one of the man's arms to his chest, and followed through with a hook to his floating ribs. Bones broke. The man staggered back. John took a short step, brought his heel down on the man's knee. Three more punches and the man was against the ropes. Then he stopped moving. His arm and leg and neck tilted at unnatural angles. The three other men moved. The one with the bloody nose grabbed an iron bar. John didn't need orders this time. Three attackers at once. He had to take them out before they surrounded him. He might be faster, but he didn't have eyes in the back of his head. The man with the iron bar swung a vicious blow at John's ribs. John sidestepped, grabbed the man's hand, and clamped it to the bar. He twisted the bar and crushed the bones of his attacker's wrist. John snapped a side kick toward the second man, caught him in the groin, crushing the soft organs and breaking his target's pelvis. John pulled the bar free, whipped around, and caught the third man in the neck. Hitting him so hard, the ODST was propelled over the ropes.
"At ease, number 117,
Chief Petty Officer Mendez barked. John obeyed and dropped the bar. Like the pin, it seemed to take too long for the impromptu weapon to hit the deck. The ODSTs lay crumpled on the ground, either unconscious or dead. Mendez, at the far end of the gym, strode toward the boxing ring. The sergeant stood with his mouth open.
"Chief Mendez, sir,"
he snapped a crisp salute.
"What are you—"
He turned to John. His eyes widened, and he murmured,
"He's one of them, isn't he?"
"Medics are on the way,"
Mendez said calmly. He stepped closer to the sergeant.
"There are two intel officers waiting for you in ops. They'll debrief you."
He stepped back.
"I suggest you report to them immediately."
"Yes, sir,"
the sergeant said. He almost ran out of the gym. He looked once over his shoulder at John. Then he moved even faster.
"Your workout is over for today,"
Mendez told John. John saluted and left the ring. A team of medics entered with stretchers and rushed toward the boxing ring.
"Permission to speak, sir?" John said.
Mendez nodded.
"Were those men part of a mission? Were they targets or teammates?"
John knew this had to be some sort of mission. The chief had been too close for it to be a coincidence.
"You engaged and neutralized a threat," Mendez replied. That action seems to have answered your question, squad leader.
John wrinkled his forehead as he thought it through. I followed the chain of command, he said. The sergeant told me to fight. I was threatened and in imminent danger, but they were still UNSC Special Forces, fellow soldiers.
Mendez lowered his voice. Not every mission has simple objectives or comes to a logical conclusion. Your priorities are to follow the orders in your chain of command, and then to preserve your life and the lives of your team. Is that clear?
Sir, John said. Yes, sir. He glanced back at the ring. Blood was seeping into the canvas mat. John had an odd feeling in the pit of his stomach. He hit the showers and let the blood rinse off him. He felt strangely sorry for the men he had killed. But he knew his duty. The chief had even been unusually verbose in order to clarify the matter. Follow orders and keep himself and his team safe. That's all he had to focus on. John didn't give the incident in the gym another thought. Chapter 8 0930 Hours September 11th 2525 Military Calendar Epsilon Eridani System Reach UNSC Military Complex Planet Reach Dr. Halsey reclined in Mendez's padded chair. She considered pilfering one of the Sweet William cigars from the box on his desk. See why he considered them such a treat. The stench wafting from the box, however, was too overwhelming. How did he stand them? The door opened, and CPO Mendez halted in the doorway.
"Ma'am," he said, and stood straighter, "I wasn't informed that you would be visiting today. In fact, I had understood that you were out of the system for another week. I would have made arrangements."
"I'm sure you would have." She folded her hands in her lap. "Our situation has changed. Where are my Spartans? They are not in their barracks, nor on any of the ranges."
Mendez hesitated.
"They can no longer train here, ma'am. We have had to find them other facilities."
Dr. Halsey stood and smoothed the pleats in her gray skirt.
"Maybe you should explain that statement, Chief."
"I could," he replied, "but it will be easier to show you."
"Very well,"
Dr. Halsey said, her curiosity piqued. Mendez escorted her to his personal warthog, parked outside his office. The all-terrain combat vehicle had been refitted. The heavy chain gun on the back had been removed and replaced with a rack of Argent V missiles. Mendez drove them off the base and onto winding mountain roads.
"Reach was first colonized for its rich titanium deposits," Mendez told her. "There are mines in these mountains thousands of meters deep. The UNSC uses them for storage."
"I presume you do not have my Spartans taking inventory today, Chief?"
"No, ma'am. We just need the privacy."
Mendez drove the warthog past a manned guardhouse and into a large tunnel that sloped steeply underground. The road wound down in a spiral, deeper into solid granite. Mendez said,
"Do you remember the Navy's first experiments with powered exoskeletons?"
"I'm not sure I see the connection between this place, my Spartans, and the exoskeleton projects," Dr. Halsey replied, frowning. "But I'll play along a bit further. Yes, I know all about the Mark I prototypes. We had to scrap the concept and redesign battle armor from the ground up for the Mjolnir project. The Mark I's consumed enormous energy. Either they had to be plugged into a generator or use inefficient broadcast power. Neither option is practical on a battlefield."
Mendez decelerated slightly as he approached a speed bump. The warthog's massive tires thudded over the obstacle.
"They used the units that weren't scrapped," Dr. Halsey continued, "as dock loaders to move heavy equipment."
She cocked one eyebrow.
"Or might they have been dumped in a place like this?"
"There are dozens of the suits here."
"You haven't put my Spartans in some of those antiques?"
"No. Their trainers are using them for their own safety," Mendez replied. "When the Spartans recovered from microgravity therapy, they were eager to get back to their routine. However, we experienced some..."
He paused, searching for the right word.
"Difficulties."
He glanced at his passenger. His face was grim.
their first day back, three trainers were accidentally killed during hand-to-hand combat exercises.
Dr. Halsey cocked an eyebrow.
Then they are faster and stronger than we anticipated?
That, Mendez replied, would be understating the situation.
The tunnel opened into a large cavern. There were lights scattered on the walls, overhead 100 meters up on the ceiling, and along the floor, but they did little to dissipate the overwhelming darkness. Mendez parked the Warthog next to a small, prefabricated building. He jumped out and helped Dr. Halsey step from the vehicle.
"This way, please," Mendez gestured to the room. "We'll have a better view from inside."
The building had three glass walls and several monitors marked motion, infrared, Doppler, and passive. Mendez pushed a button, and the room climbed a track along the wall until they were 20 meters off the floor. Mendez keyed a microphone and spoke.
"Lights!"
Floodlights snapped on and illuminated a section of the cavern the size of a football field. In the center stood a concrete bunker. Three men in the primitive Mark I power armor stood on top. Six more stood evenly spaced around the perimeter. A red banner had been planted in the center of the bunker.
"Capture the flag?" Dr. Halsey asked. "Past all